Okay. Where is Turkey? How many, without looking now, don't look. How many of you know where Turkey is, really? I think most of you know where Egypt and Saudi Arabia are. Arabia, right across the Suez Canal from Egypt. You know where that is, and Sudan. But where is Turkey? Well, Turkey is not below Saudi Arabia. Many people think that. Yemen and Oman are below Saudi Arabia. Above Saudi Arabia, no, not Turkey there. That's Iraq. And above that, to the west, Syria. Where is Turkey? Turkey is right next to Greece on the Mediterranean. We all think of Turkey as pretty much a Muslim country in the Middle East. Well, it is. It's in, what, Western Asia? Turkey is a big country. It has the world's fourth largest army. It is directly east of Greece. It's a very interesting country. Lots of ancient architecture there that takes our history way back. But what about Turkey geopolitically? Turkey, due north of Syria, directly north of Syria and west, was obviously involved in the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad. Was Syria involved? I have no knowledge of that. But it's obvious that Turkey was deeply involved with that. Let's find out more from Mitch Henderson about Turkey and why we should care about Turkey. What's the big deal with Turkey? Hello, Mitch. Welcome back.
Hello. I hope to give you a tool, give everybody a tool that they can use to understand Turkey so that they can interpret the events of the Middle East. Turkey is key to Armageddon, to World War III, to nuclear war. Turkey has everything to do with it. And what I'd like to do is draw a picture of Turkey for you so you understand how they are. How a nation sees the world is shaped by its culture and history. They are not like us, okay? They have a different history and a different culture. You can see this clearly in the United States. Reliably, over time, most black people, Asians, Latinos, and Native Americans are Democrats. Their culture and history are different from white people's culture. They see the world differently. They have collectivist cultures. They are not individualists, and that's what makes the difference between them and the white people. Individualists can be Republicans, okay? So, let me get started.
And listen, unless you're a rhino, and then you're a communist.
Yeah, listen, if you know an Asian who is an individualist, that does not disprove what I just said. I'm talking about the culture. Individuals can wander off in any direction at all. Okay, so the Turks are Muslim. In Islam, the state, the culture, and the religion are one. Consequently, to explain the nuances in the Turkish worldview, I will need to explain some theology. In any religion, there is a spectrum of how people experience their faith. The major division is between worldly and the transcendent. Within worldly experience, there are levels of experience based on intensity of understanding and devotion to the practice of the faith. Three levels can be generalized. First, the aesthetic. This is a superficial understanding of religion based on the trappings of the faith. For example, finding comfort in the church architecture, the ritual beauty, the music, and the fellowship. The vast majority of religious people fall into this group, regardless of what religion you are. This is what most people fall into. A step above that is the ethical. This is finding comfort and affirmation in the moral precepts of the faith and a devotion to those morals, mostly exhibited in social works and virtue signaling. Those are not totally sincere, but a few are. For example, most preachers and priests fall into this category. Then the third is the spiritual, those who are devoted to loving and obeying their God. This is religion beyond just the moral and aspires to love. As for the transcendent, you are unlikely to have ever met anyone who has left this world behind and is truly otherworldly. If you did meet one, you probably wouldn't recognize it. So, in Islam, the three levels are as follows. The aesthetic is called the Ummah, or the Muslim community. It focuses on the Quran. This is what most Muslims are. The second is the ethical, or the ulema, or the scholars of Islamic doctrine and law. They focus on the hadith, which is a more involved book. These are fewer than religious leaders. Then the spiritual. This is the Sufi, or the spiritual who are seeking mystical union with God. In most religions, they would form a small minority of people, but in some nations, like Senegal, it is the predominant form of Islam. So in Senegal, Sufi is the norm, and most of those Sufis are worldly and at the aesthetic level of religious experience, even though the religion they follow is mystical. So the Ummah and Ulema do not care for the Sufism because instead of devotion to the Prophet Muhammad, they seek a direct relationship with God. An example of the Sufi outlook can be seen in a poem from Haluddin al-Rumi, a 13th century Persian Sufi. You will see why the majority of Muslims could not relate and why even the Pope, with his ecumenism, saying that all religions lead to God, would have a problem with him. He basically says that the Ummah and Ulema do not know God, but al-Rumi has everything to do with modern Turkey and modern Iran. It is at the heart of the Iranian Islamic Revolution, as propounded by Ali Shariati, the philosopher of the Iranian Revolution. The Ayatollah Khomeini followed Haluddin al-Rumi also. He was a fan. So let me just say this thing so that you can relate to where their head is at. So I'm quoting Haluddin al-Rumi. I tried to find him on the Christian cross, but he was not there. I went to the temple of the Hindus and to the old pagodas, but I could not find a trace of him anywhere. I searched in the mountains and in the valleys, but neither in the heights nor in the depths could I find him. I went to the Kaaba in Mecca, but he was not there either. I questioned the scholars and the philosophers, but he was beyond their understanding. I then looked into my heart, and it was there that I found him. He was nowhere else to be found. Now, you can see in that the transcendent, where, you know, of course, he's directly communicating with God, and the prophet is just a distraction for him, okay? So please keep this in mind as I describe the development of modern Turkey, because it is not the Islam that we're familiar with through our propaganda. So let's start. What we're interested in is the Turks in Turkey. We're not interested in all the people that lived there before the Turks came. Okay, they more or less got absorbed into the Turkish population. So this started with the Seljuks, who had an empire from 1037 to 1194. The Seljuks were nomadic Turkish raiders who lived along the Sirdarya River and around the Aral Sea in what is now southwestern Kazakhstan. In 1037, they began raiding and conquering the land around them. By 1194, their empire included what is today southern Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, north and western Afghanistan, Iran, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel. It was the Iranians that taught the Seljuks to be Muslim. And at the time, Iran was Sunni Muslim. Since the Seljuks had no written language, they used Persian script instead of Arabic, and they adopted Persian literary styles and poetry. They co-opted local rulers to administer their governments. Turkey was not Turkish until the Seljuks arrived. There were many people living in the area. The Seljuks let business and industry flourish under their control. At this time, a Seljuk Turkey was the most developed and prosperous area in the known world. Trade was good. Life was good for the people. As a matter of fact, it was the Seljuk Turks that helped spread the use of Persian script and language in Iran. In other words, they got it from the Iranians, but they're the ones who spread it now. Turks were culturally, ethnically, and religiously tolerant. You can see this model being established in Syria under al-Jilani, under the tutelage of Erdogan today. So the next big empire was the Mongols, and they held sway from 1200 to 1368. The Mongols were herdsmen of the eastern steppes north of China. The Mongol Empire lasted from 1200 to 1368. Their empire was humongous, stretching from Europe to China, from Siberia to the Indian Ocean, and included all of Turkish Central Asia. adopted them. They were able to do this because these horsemen of the steppes had a revolution and military organization. Instead of tribal organizations built upon tribal royalties and tribal leadership, they adopted the Chinese model of military bureaucracies. Tribes did not matter. The old tribal organization was unstable. It was hard to keep the army together. The bureaucratic system divided units into tens, hundreds, thousands, and 10,000, 100,000. The leaders of these units were appointed without regard to kinship. Unit leaders were appointed according to ability and merit instead of hereditary tribal leadership. An ordinary peasant could rise to command a unit of 10,000 based on ability. Armies were not built upon tribal ties or loyalty. They were often tenuous anyway and unreliable. When the Mongol army defeated an enemy army, they would divide those army into tens, hundreds, and thousands and put one of their own men over them. This allowed the Mongol army to explode across Eurasia, going from the Sea of Japan and the South China Sea to the borders of Poland and Romania within 50 years. Also, from the Chinese, they learned about the utilization of scouts and spies and had a very well-developed logistical system. The Mongols
Mitch, just real quick.
Yes.
Would you rate their overall military strategies, tactics, and preparation? Were they pretty sharp? Massive army. An army marches on its stomach. They got to feed a lot of people.
This was a revolution in military affairs. This was effective because it was a meritocracy.
Okay.
That was one thing.
That's smart.
You didn't inherit anything.
That's the way it ought to be.
It was based on merit. So right. The Mongols were completely tolerant of other races, ethnicities, cultures, and religions. They were most interested in free and open trade, which burgeoned under their tutelage. Uh-huh. This is what helped with their logistics. This was the time of Marco Polo. Even an Italian guy could trade across Asia to China unmolested. Just as they incorporated enemy armies into their own army by the bureaucracy, they incorporated their new lands and people into their empire. As you can see, the way the Mongols ruled was quite similar to the Seljuks. Like the Seljuks, they adapted to the cultures they conquered rather than the other way around. Keep that in mind. The Seljuks adapted to the Iranians. The Mongols adapted to whoever they were. Right. They would just do it. In China, the Mongol leaders assimilated to Chinese culture. In the Middle East, they adopted the Persian cultures like the Seljuks had. You will notice that both the large Seljuk Empire as well as the large Mongol Empire did not last very long. It is the Tower of Babel problem. Each tribe or culture eventually separated itself from the empire, and it fell apart. When it was together, it became rich and advanced, but it had the inherent weaknesses of birds of a feather flock together, or ethnic nationalism. While these empires were together, it held together by the conqueror, leaving the different peoples alone and letting them live as they wished. It was a business relationship that placated them for a while. This is like the difference between the Democratic Party model of trying to force everyone to be the same and getting into their business that makes people unhappy, as opposed to the Republican model of leaving people alone and letting them tend to their own business. People are happier when you leave them alone. The Democrats try to impose their narrative while the Republicans leave you alone. The Seljuks and Mongols ruled like the Republicans. An effective bureaucracy can foster the economy if it otherwise leaves people alone. The Turks learned this from the Mongols. You can see this reflected in what Turkey is doing in Syria. Al-Jolani is trying to integrate all of the militias and armies in Syria together into one bureaucratically run army and wants to let each ethnic group and religious sect go about their business unmolested. Erdogan is a student of history. Okay, now you asked a question about their tactics. Another thing they developed is originally when they raided, they just had cavalry, like just horse cavalry. But they learned from the Chinese to have an infantry and a cavalry to back that infantry up. So there's benefits to infantry and there's benefits to cavalry, and they use them both. In warfare. And that was a new change coming across the steppes also. Okay, so the next empire was the Ottoman Empire. It started in 1300 and lasted to 1922. The Ottoman Empire began in northwestern Turkey, an area that the Mongols had not conquered. In 1300, Osman I started expanding by attacking the Christian Byzantine Empire, not the Mongols.
Did you say, Mitch,
Yes.
Osman?
Yes, Osman I.
Okay, I now I got it. I couldn't figure out. I think it's pronounced Osman, but
maybe
whatever.
Maybe it's Osman, yeah.
I wanted to make sure I got the thing right in my head. Okay, because I do remember reading about Osman. Maybe that's just an affectation.
I think I got confused by the Osman family.
Donnie and Marie, of course. Well, that would confuse anybody.
Right.
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, no problem.
So, because of the powerful and rich Timurid Empire to the east, the Ottomans expanded mostly west and north into Europe at first. The Timurid Empire expanded to the east and held all the lands that the Seljuk Empire had except Turkey. The Timurids took Pakistan and parts of India. By the time that the Timurid Empire fell in 1507, the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent had taken what is now Iraq from the Timurids. The Ottoman Empire did not expand into Iran. The Turkish raiders that invaded Christian Europe were looking to rape, pillage, and plunder, just as they traditionally did. Instead of merely having a chieftain or king authorize their land piracy, they did it in the name of Islam. They did it for Allah to make the infidels submit. After all, Islam means submission to God. Because the Turks were enamored of the Persian mystics, these Turkish raiders were Sufi Muslims. Let's just say that they were extremely worldly Sufis who did not really have the heart that Haluddin al-Rumi was talking about. In other words, Sufi mystic raider is a complete oxymoron. Remember I said that Ali Shariati was the religious philosopher of the modern Islamic revolution that broke upon the world scene in 1979? This is the same kind of thing, ultra-religious Muslims that submit to God to justify their hate and murder. It is apparently an old thing in Islam, a normal thing in Islam. There are Sufi mystic followers of al-Rumi in Turkey called the Swirling Dervishes, who do not murder their fellow human beings. They spin in an effort to get close to God. It's like taking LSD or something like that.
I think it might have been whirling dervishes, but whatever. The idea is that they were going, the whirling dervishes were going round and around and around, and they'd kind of get dizzy and almost pass out. That was pretty crazy.
Yeah, they get high from it.
Yes.
They would actually learn to compose themselves and not lose their balance, so that they could whirl more and more and more and more, and they would get a buzz off of this. So and this connection with God. Okay.
Yeah.
So they are serious about their mysticism. They try to leave this world behind. Okay. So once an area was conquered by the Ottomans, wanted to build infrastructure and encourage commerce. Normally, they would want to leave people alone and let them administer themselves. But in majority Christian Europe, they first had to encourage the locals to become Muslim so that they could create a Muslim-majority population. They called these non-Muslim people the Dhimmi, and they had to pay a jizya, a tax. The jizya tax was protection money. If you paid, you were protected. If not, you were enslaved, imprisoned, or killed. If you converted to Islam, you did not have to pay the jizya. However, most people kept their Christianity, and Muslims never became the majority in Balkan Europe. This was the first part of the Ottoman Empire to fall apart, having the Greek War of Independence in 1821 and the Balkan Wars for Independence in 1912. It was the Balkan situation that led to World War I and the ultimate fall of the Ottoman Empire. Only Albania with 46%, Bosnia with 51%, and Kosovo with 96% have large Muslim populations today in the Balkans. This Muslim and Christian split led to the Balkan Wars of 1991-1999. Historically, where you have a mix of Christians and Muslims, there will be strife and war. To control the strife, you must have an authoritarian state and internal censorship and intense brainwashing to keep the peace. Therefore, you can clearly understand the motive for woke European governments to import masses of Muslim people into their countries, literally to balkanize them or divide a nation into mutually hostile groups, which empowers the state at the expense of the liberty of the people in order to keep the peace. This was one of the Biden administration's goals in open borders for woke identity politics, to take our freedom away by having a plethora of mutually hostile groups and to nurture that hostility with critical race theory. At any rate, by 1683, the Ottoman Empire was huge. It encompassed what is now Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Albania, Greece, Crimea, Russian territory around the Black Sea, Turkey, Armenia, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and Algeria. It was huge. Between 1520 and 1566, the Ottoman Empire was the wealthiest and most militarily powerful nation in the world. It had a flourishing art, architecture, and scholarship scene. If you lived in the Ottoman Empire at this time, it was like being an American now. You were living in the richest, most powerful, most advanced, most influential nation on earth. There was no better place to be or to be from. Life was very good and very comfortable. This is what Erdogan wants to recreate for Turkey today. It is Turkey's dream. He knows he cannot do this through the European Union, who will not let him join, nor through NATO, who just uses Turkey. It is because almost all trade with Europe went through the Ottoman Empire that caused the Spanish to send Columbus west to reach China and India to cut out the Turk middlemen, and caused the Portuguese to send Vasco da Gama east to do the same. Ottoman administration was very effective at the time. There were four branches of the central government, and you can see this happening in Syria. First, there was the Sultan's office. Now, this isn't exactly what Syria does, okay, because this was something the Ottomans, innovation they had. The Sultan's office, with all his regional governors and administrative officials, was the central government. Okay, to have one of these jobs, you had to be an actual slave of the Sultan. All your property, your life, and your person were the personal property of the Sultan to do with what he wanted. This kept his officials honest, since they had nothing to gain by corruption. And if they got caught, the Sultan could just summarily execute them without trial or appeal because they were slaves. Okay. This kept the government in line and kept them from being predators upon the people in their country. Okay. The second group was the military, which was responsible for the security and expansion of the empire. Then the administration, which were like civil servants in modern nation, the workers in the various ministries. And finally, the fourth one was the religious leaders that were tasked with maintaining Islamic religion and culture, because the culture was supposed to hold the empire together. A common culture, not common people, but a common culture. If you were not in the Sultan's court, called the port, you were the rayyat, or a person under the Sultan's protection. Your job was to farm, engage in industry, or trade, so that you could enrich the empire and pay taxes to keep the empire running. The Sultan's government was to make that easy for you to do, not to put burdens in your way. If you get rich, it only makes the Sultan get richer. This is the way of the Seljuks and the way that the Mongols did things. All jobs were based on strict meritocracy, just like Genghis Khan's Mongols. Just like the Seljuks and the Mongols, all affairs outside the realm of the Sultan were carried out by the millet. The millet was made up of both religions, trades, and occupations that organized themselves as they saw fit and made rules for themselves. The Sultan did not get involved in this. Religious leaders of Christian, Jewish, or other religions were then directly responsible to the Sultan instead of to the local leaders. This gave them true autonomy. Leaving the details to the locals gave the people a feeling of autonomy and freedom. It kept them from rebelling because they did not feel oppressed. All ultimately, it was secularism that brought the Ottoman Empire down. They abandoned the Seljuk and Mongol way of administration. In 1889, an organization was formed by anti-religious enlightened people called the Committee of Union and Progress, based on the Jacobins of the French Revolution. They called themselves the Young Turks. They believed in progressivism. Progressivism is a leftist political philosophy and reform movement that wants to advance the human condition through social reform, primarily based on advances in social organization, science, and technology. They are the trust the science people who believe that they should rely on scientific evidence and the work of scientists to run society. In other words, they are like authoritarians like Anthony Fauci that ruled our world during the COVID epidemic. You know what kind of people these are. You have experienced it. The COVID lockdowns were the segue into the woke totalitarian state that the Biden regime had become. We can directly relate to the kind of state that the Young Turks wanted. The Young Turks were like woke Democrats, okay? The Young Turk Revolution of 1908 ended the absolute monarchy of the Ottoman Empire. From 1913 until 1918, the Young Turks and the CUP ruled Turkey as a dictatorship. What the CUP wanted to achieve in the Ottoman Empire was as follows. One, end income inequality and create income equity. End mass incarceration and remove religion from the government. In World War I, Turkey sided with Germany and Austria-Hungary against the Allies, the U.S., U.K., and Russia. The Young Turks and CUP could see that the multinational Ottoman Empire was going to fall apart and pushed for Turkish nationalism. In order to secure Anatolia, which is modern Turkey, as a purely secular and Turkish state, the CUP and Young Turks began an ethnic cleansing of Turkey of non-Turk Christian ethnic groups. Under Enver Pasha, the Armenian genocide of 1915-1917 murdered 1.5 million Christian Armenians.
At least. At least.
Yes, at least.
I think that's very conservative.
The Assyrian Christian genocide of 1915 murdered 275,000 Assyrian Christians, and the Pontic Greek genocide of northern Turkey murdered 750,000 Greek Christians. The ethnic Turk population of Anatolia was 80% before these genocides and 98% afterwards. I need to point out here that the genocide of these people was not committed by an Islamic sultanate like Saudi Arabia, but by a progressive and enlightened government like the American Biden administration. We can remember what it was like to live under them. That is what it was like to live in the final days of the Ottoman Empire. If Harris had won, they probably would have begun ethnic cleansing of white people from the United States. When World War I ended, the Turkish War of Independence ran from 1919 into 1923. Uh-huh. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who is a darling of Western liberals, okay, was a general who had been a Young Turk and a member of the CUP. However, Atatürk did not like Enver Pasha and figured out that relations with the rest of the world would be better if he distanced himself from the genocidal CUP. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk is the most important person in 20th century Turkey and is credited with forming the modern Turkish state. His politics is called Kemalism and is based on positivism, which can be called the religion of science. Atatürk was an atheist and a Turkish nationalist. Kemalism is described in the six eras, which were as follows. First, Republican. Republicanism, which means no hereditary rule. Two, folkism, which means that the meaning of everything comes from the common usage and understanding of the people rather than abstract ideas. Three, nationalism, means that Turkey is for Turks and everyone in Turkey must assimilate into the Turkish ethnic group. In fact, Turkey maintained ethnic cleansing well into the 1950s. The Kurds would argue that it continues even until today. The fourth one, laicism, which means far more than mere separation of church and state. In Turkey, it means the separation of religion from the whole public sphere, political, jurisprudence, education, and society. Ataturk made wearing Islamic clothing illegal in public, to include women wearing headscarves or burqas. He made Turkish use the Roman alphabet instead of the Persian script. The fifth one is statism, which means all control is centralized, including centralized control of all economic and social activity. After Ataturk died, it was a serious crime to speak ill of him or make fun of him. Okay? It is today, to this very day. Go throw some mud on a statue at Ataturk, and you'll spend about 10 years in jail. Okay? Wow. Reformism was the sixth one, which meant to reform Turkish culture, society, and politics into a modern society commensurate with the liberal society that existed in modern Europe. As you can see, Ataturk did things opposite of what the Seljuks, Mongols, and Ottoman Empire did. Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a Sufi Muslim and a neo-Ottomanist. He admits being a Sufi Muslim, but although he is in fact a neo-Ottomanist, he won't publicly admit it. He wants to bring back the Seljuk, Mongol, and Ottoman ways. He is a secret Islamist, but cannot speak about it because Turkey's constitution does not allow Islamist parties to be in office or run for elections. Erdogan found this out the hard way in 1998. As the mayor of Istanbul, he wrote out loud a poem by Ziya Gökalp, which compared mosques to military barracks and the Muslim faithful to an army. Erdogan was convicted of inciting religious hatred and sentenced to a year in prison. When he got out, he founded the AKP, or the Justice and Development Party. Erdogan wants to revive both the Ottoman Empire and its influence in the Middle East. Starting in 2019, he began discussions with Russia and Iran to split influence of the Middle East. Iran would have influence over the Shia Muslim, mostly in Iraq, which is 69% Shia, and Yemen, which is 35% Shia Muslim. Iraq used to be under British control after the Ottoman Empire fell apart, according to the Sykes-Picot Treaty. Turkey would have the influence over the Sunni Muslim, including the French territories of the Sykes-Picot Treaty of Syria, which is 74% Sunni, and Lebanon, which is 32% Sunni. Al-Jolani in Syria is trying to build an Ottoman-like state in Syria, allowing
Mitch, excuse me.
Yes.
Can you please differentiate for people the difference between Sunni and Shia, and how many of all Muslims are approximately each? Sunni and Shia.
Well, Sunni is about 80% of Muslims.
It's the dominant majority, yes.
Yeah, it's the majority. Now, the Shia are a minority, and the Shia believe that there was a dispute in Baghdad, you know, many hundreds of years ago, where the Ali was supposed to be the next caliph, but the Sunnis put somebody else there in charge. Okay, and so what Shia means is Shia Ali, which means the party of Ali. Okay, and they think that Ali didn't really die; he just went into occultation, and he will return, a Christ-like figure returning in the end times to liberate the Shia people.
Okay.
So the Sunni consider them apostate. Okay.
Yeah.
And vice versa. Okay. So Al-Jolani in Syria is trying to build an Ottoman state in Syria, allowing minority faiths and ethnicity self-rule like the Turkish millets. Each religion and ethnicity must respect each other and the majority, like in the Ottoman Empire. There is to be just one military, like the Ottoman Empire, with no militias allowed. The only holdout is the Kurds in northeast Syria, who the United States keeps in opposition even though the Assad regime is gone. The government will be centralized like the Ottoman Porte, and there will be a religious office, and the centralized administration will be selected according to merit, not sectarianism. you'll notice that when Al-Jilani started appointing people to the government, he appointed people according to merit. If they can do the job and they're the best for the job, he appointed them, including a female to be head of the Central Bank of Syria. Okay, so merit means everything, because merit will work. Okay. So Turkey has a similar plans for Lebanon, which is about one-third Shia, one-third Sunni, and one-third Christian. Turkey is going to build a naval base near Beirut. Turkey is a NATO nation, so the theory is that Israel cannot attack it. This naval base will offer Beirut some protection. If Turkish air defenses see Israeli jets as a threat, they can shoot them down. Israel will not have freedom of the skies. Turkey wants to bring Hezbollah under control the Ottoman way. And it looks like Hezbollah is going along with this, okay? It'll be a slow process. They don't want the whole world to see it happening. They want it to develop. They want it to happen. And they don't want Western approval for it. They could care less what we think, okay? They want Lebanon to have one army under control of a centralized Lebanese government. This is a work in progress. This is what the Mongols, the Seljuks, the Ottomans did, okay? Turkey's long-term goal is to liberate Palestine and have an Ottoman-like government there also. Everyone's
They better hurry. Yeah. They're running out of time, so they're going to liberate Palestine. There won't be any Palestine left if Trump and Netanyahu have their way. They're going to vacuum everybody out of Gaza and the West Bank. So what's left? Go ahead.
Well, they're not going to worry about that. They're going to take it anyway. Okay.
I think you're right.
Everyone's dream is to liberate the Palestinian people and give them their land back. The legacy that Erdogan desires is that he liberates Palestine and destroys Israel forever so there can finally be peace in the Middle East. Of course, he knows that the destruction of Israel would probably result in world peace. That is what he wants to be remembered for. Russia will have influence over the Christians in the Middle East. Although there are no Christian nations, there are many Christians in Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. Russia is going to keep its military bases in Syria. It was actually never in danger of losing them, or they were never in danger of losing their influence in Syria. Syria cannot look to the United States for development because even though Assad is gone, U.S. sanctions on Assad remain. The United States is just an asshole about everything. Okay? Russia is the only major power that will work with them. Sunni Turkey will also serve as a bridge to the Sunni Arab nations. When Damascus fell, it was the beginning of the end for Israel. Russia, Iran, and Turkey will be working in concert to liberate Palestine. China will back Iran, as will Russia. Trump will start this war with Iran, but it's not the old Iran. Iran is no longer on its own. It now will work in concert with Russia and Turkey with the backing of China. China has a naval base in Djibouti on the Horn of Africa. They have pre-positioned supplies. In case of war with the United States, China, North Korea, and Iran have large fifth column presence already in the United States to interrupt communications and logistics and to destroy infrastructure.
You know how many communist Chinese are in the U.S., Mitch?
Root them out.
Mitch, do you know how many communist Chinese, PLA, CCP, live here in the U.S. right now? 5.5 million.
They have, like in Boston, they have Chinese Communist Party clubs up there.
There you go.
Because, you know, how are these people refugees if they join the local Communist Party when they get here? How is that a refugee? Excuse me. So Christian America will pay heavily for Israel's adventures in the Middle East. All who you love and care about will perish for Israel and the Jews in a nuclear war. What does Israel do for us? Israel is the end of America. Israel is the end of all American hopes and dreams. Israel will drag America and Americans into the pit of hell. Afterwards, I doubt anyone will worship Israel again, because that's what people do right now. You should just see. You can look at, like when Bibi came to talk to Trump, it was just gushing thousands of comments about, oh, thank God, Netanyahu's coming to America. God bless Netanyahu. God bless Israel. These are Christian Americans saying this. You know, they just don't know. That's the Antichrist that they're talking about, you know. Listen, Israel has the Bogen David. It's a six-pointed stars, six-pointed star, okay? It's got 6 points, six triangles, and six inner angles, 666. That is the mark of the beast. If you worship Israel, you are worshiping the Antichrist, okay? That is the mark of the Antichrist, is the Star of David, okay? I say that with full conviction, okay?
No arguments here.
No. So this
whole situation is
Turkey's point of view.
It's rotting.
Okay.
Rotting. Yeah. Rotting away. I don't know. Yeah. This, you've got now apparently thousands of Jewish soldiers, tanks, APCs, probably howitzers, lots of weapons and munitions in Syria right now. What the hell are they doing there? They're there, and they're not going to leave. That's what they're doing there. It's called
Greater Israel. They're against the law. They're against international law.
No laws apply to them.
Let me explain something. When we have this BRICS versus NATO thing, the United States keeps thinking that they're gonna draw India away from Russia. Okay. But to understand why that won't happen, just think about Israel and the United States. See, Israel can get away with war crimes, genocide, ethnic cleansing, attacking other lands and taking their land. They can get away with it because they have the United States to veto any resolutions against them doing that. Okay? So what we have in India has territorial dispute with Pakistan. And Kashmir, okay? Kashmir is almost all Muslim, but India controls it. And the United States is, in fact, the ally of Pakistan, okay? I know this. Back when they, in 1971, when they had the war in Bangladesh, I was just going into the Army. I was in basic training. We even used to sit there and sing a song. We'd go, 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Pakistan, because we were alerted that we were going to probably ship out to Pakistan to back them up in a war against India. People forget that. We were always on Pakistan's side. And who is it that whenever some resolution comes out to condemn India for what's going on in Kashmir, who vetoes that in the United Nations? No. Russia does, reliably. Every they always. In other words, Russia gives India impunity like the Americans give Israel impunity.
Got it.
India is not going to give that up because they can't trust the United States. You know, if you're not Jewish, the United States is not trustworthy. You know, they're not going to. They will do what they want. They will stab you in the back. Okay, and India knows that. They know we will. They know that we are unreliable. They're not going to. They're not going to turn their back on Russia. They need Russia, just like Israel needs the United States.
No arguments here.
There's another thing. There's another thing I wanted to bring up that's unrelated to this, but you know, the helicopter crash in Washington D.C. There's something very, very unusual going on, and that's this Captain Rebecca Lobot. They did not want to name her right away.
It took them three days to name her.
You know
three
what
days.
It means when they don't want to name you? It means there's something wrong. Okay.
Well.
So she. You know, what about her is that, you know, she's accused of being a DEI hire. Well, she is a lesbian, okay? And her family says that. They said she's a daughter, a sister, a partner, and a friend.
Right, right.
Okay? So partner means lesbian, right?
Yeah.
You can read between the lines, okay? She's a sharp advocate in the Army. That means she assists women in bringing charges against men for sexual harassment, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And she's also a White House aide for Biden. She's actually
She wormed her way in there, Mitch. Wormed her way into the White House and was showing people around, giving tours, speaking to groups of people. Yes.
Yeah.
I think you saw the same article I did.
So, do you know how here's another thing. Look everywhere, and you will find no information about her family. It's very difficult to find anything about her family. But her father, his name is David F. Lobach. He is a professor of medicine at Duke University Medical School. Okay. He's a specialist in the genome and in tailoring medical treatment to the genes. In other words, COVID-19 was produced to kill old white people, and
he's involved with any genetics are very suspicious for openers. Now, in all likelihood, that's a Jewish family, all right?
Well, I don't think they're Jewish, but they work for a Jewish, I forget her name, is Celine something. They work for his boss and the people that handle the funding of this research and stuff. They are definitely Jewish people.
Okay. I'd say
as a matter of fact, they're part of Jewish charities.
Yes.
So now keep in mind that Duke University, has a school in Singapore. It's called Duke NUS, or Duke National University, Singapore. Okay, it's a medical school there. It was one of those people who actually worked on gain of function for the COVID virus. So Duke University was involved in this. Okay, so. I think what they don't want to do. Not only that, but Duke University has a thing in Shanghai, China too. It's called Duke Kunshan University. Okay, so University of North Carolina, Dr. Daszak. And this is around that same area, Chapel Hill and whatnot.
Peter Daszak,
That created the COVID.
A lot of that came from Chapel Hill. That's correct.
Yes,
you're right.
It did,
totally
and that's where this girl is from. And I think that the family does not want her connected with the family because they're already under heat and under the microscope for the COVID research. They don't want this to blow up and be public everywhere. That her dad had something to do with a worldwide epidemic that killed, hundreds of people, plus the flu took credit for it.
The COVID death rate now around the world is probably several hundred million, at least.
Yeah. So he's responsible for has a hand in this. Okay, so
nothing would surprise me. Yeah.
I'm sure that they want to... keep that kind of private and stuff. Not only that, but there's questions. If she's this pilot flying around all the time, how's she got time to be at the White House doing all this stuff and everything? Okay. Was it a case where she had a privileged position at the White House and then she went and got some flying time in once in a while? This is what I'm thinking. Flying time in because she was on a check ride. Okay.
And, she only had 450 hours this last year.
Oh, yeah. Not only that, but if you look at it, it's like the helicopter dove down onto the airplane to take.
I watched it. It is concerning. Angles can be funny things, as you know. I don't know. All I know is there's a lot on the table here. There's going to be an investigation that will take a year and a half, 2 years. Could it be covered up? Anything like that? Yes. Aircraft
definitely
be flown? RC? Absolutely. Was there somebody of high value on that aircraft that had to be taken out under a fake name? Possible. Look, there are a lot of things on the table here.
Or you know, don't discount the fact that it was actually a DEI issue. And they're never going to want to admit that.
With Loebach at the controls, or one of the two at the controls.
Yeah,
it's possible.
Loebach was at controls, because the other guy's a Czech pilot. A Czech pilot doesn't fly the helicopter. I was in helicopters. I got Czech rides. When I got Czech rides, the guy doing the Czech ride did not fly the helicopter. I flew the helicopter. That's from takeoff to landing. There's no break. The pilot has to fly it the whole time. It's an intense thing that you get graded on. So it usually makes you a little bit nervous. You're under scrutiny when you're getting a check ride. So, you know, people kind of get nervous, and you're more apt to make a mistake on a check ride than a normal
Very
time.
True.
But
Very
I think
true.
It's going to be a DEI cover-up. They just don't want to admit that it was probably a DEI
They killed
DEI
all those people
issue.
Because of DEI. And it's not the only group of people who have died, believe it. There's more.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Mitch, thank you. Good job, as always. Speak to you next week.
Okay, well, you're very welcome. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Mitch. Okay, and thanks to all of you for being here. Lots to think about. We'll be back with you tomorrow night. Take care. Have a good day. And we'll talk soon.